The Burgess Shale is a genuine scientific treasure trove in our own backyard, and it constantly surprises me how many Canadians are unaware of it. Essentially, it is the single richest deposit of fossils from the Cambrian period, which stretched from about 540 to 490 million years ago. Since its discovery in 1909, hundreds of thousands of fossils have been extracted from the shale, which lies in British Columbia's Yoho National Park. Unfortunately, the vast majority of these have remained locked up in cabinets, inaccessible to all but a handful of experts. Jean-Bernard Caron aims to change that. He's a curator of invertebrate paleontology at the Royal Ontario Museum, which holds the world's largest collection of Burgess fossils. Through a new website launched earlier this week, Caron aims to make the Burgess fossils accessible to Canadians, and indeed, people from all over the world. I spoke with him earlier in the week about the launch of the website, and I started by asking him to tell me a little bit about the term Cambrian explosion.
The Cambrian explosion means the presence of a number of fossils in the form of shelly organisms, in particular a number of shells of trilobites and brachiopods, starting at around 540 million years ago. So really, the Cambrian explosion is the emergence of animals in the fossil record. And before that, there were large multicellular organisms that had evolved during the Ediacaran time, starting at around 580 million years ago. But these organisms went extinct just before the Cambrian explosion. And we don't really know what they are, in fact. They might be early branches of the tree of animal life, forms that are really difficult to relate to non-animal groups. So again, the true animals in the pure sense of the terms, the bilaterians, the organisms with bilateral symmetry, emerged during the Cambrian explosion.
Okay, so if I understand you right, you're saying that before the Cambrian explosion, almost all life was single-celled microscopic organisms. There might have been a few multicellular organisms floating around, but they died out, and the Cambrian explosion is where we see the first evidence of animals as we would know them today.
That's right. In fact, no, most animal groups that we know today are part of this group that I mentioned being bilaterian, so with bilateral symmetry. That's pretty much 95% of the diversity of animals today. It's a unique event in life history. There's no new body plants being formed after the Cambrian explosion, and that's quite unlike other radiation events that occurred afterwards.
Okay, so let's talk about the Burgess Shale itself. I know it's not the only deposit from the period, but it is the richest, and I gather that one of the reasons for that is because, unlike many other sites where only hard parts of animals were preserved, their shells or their exoskeletons, at Burgess, soft body parts were preserved as well. Can you tell me what happened 505 million years ago that made Burgess such a rich source of soft-bodied fossil specimens?
So at the time of the Burgess Shale, when the layers, which are now fossils, were deposited, the Burgess Shale was located near the tropical zone, along the paleo continent at the time, but probably several hundred kilometers away from the nearest shore. And it is thought that the organisms that were living at the bottom of the sea at the time were, in fact, living probably in a photic zone. In other words, in an area where light can still penetrate. And this is based on the presence of algae in this community. These organisms would have been engulfed, covered, if you want, by large mud flow events at the bottom of the sea, which will have killed very quickly and buried these organisms in pretty much where they lived. And not just burying live animals, but also animals that had started to rot at the bottom, that had died prior to these events, but and started to decay. Now, this didn't happen only once, it happened dozens of times. There were dozens of burial events through time. And this is now what you can see in the field. If you go to the Boer Shell, you see quarry with very fine laminated sediments, and the fine mudstone, fine siliciclastic sediment with fossils can be seen as almost a barcode along the cliff of that quarry.
When did you first hear about the Burgess Shale, and how did you decide that you wanted to dedicate your life to studying it?
Well, I first heard about the Burgess Shale while I was in France during my undergraduate studies. In fact, I had heard about this site before. I'd always had a passion for paleontology since the age of 10. So I learned about the Burgess Shale probably during my teenagehood and started to read more seriously about the Burgess Shale at the university. Then I read Steve Jay Gould, that really inspired me, a book that was published in 1989. I probably read this book in the 1990s. And eventually I built up some experience in France doing some paleontological work in various fossil deposits. I thought that perhaps it would be good to go to the Burgess Shale and try to see by myself what it looks like. So I contacted Simon Connor Morris at the time, professor in Cambridge, who worked on the Burgess Shale, especially starting in the 1970s and 80s. And he told me, well, the ROM, Rancho Museum, organized expeditions. So you should contact Desmond Collins, the former curator here, which I did. I eventually, he let me in, inviting me in 1998 to join his crew. At the time, I had no idea, well, eventually become the curator of the Burgess Shale collection here at the ROM.
Wow. And that book you were talking about by Stephen Jay Gould, that was Wonderful Life, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Now, I read that the Royal Ontario Museum has over 150,000 specimens from the Burgess Shale. Is that right?
You have to know that the number of 150,000 specimens is an estimate. We don't actually know how many specimens we have in our collections for a very simple reason. Is that on a single slab you can have several specimens. In fact, most of the time you have an abundance of specimens, sometimes of various species on the same slab of rock. Now, in the field, when you collect a fossil, you usually don't have time to identify everything on the slab or to count specimens, or the conditions, lighting conditions in particular, are not adapted to do detailed observations of a slab. In fact, what we have here in our collection is probably around 35 to 40,000 pieces of rocks or slabs, and each of them has an average probably around, you know, between 5 and, let's say, 7 or 8 specimens.
Wait, are you saying you literally have more fossils than you have time to count?
Well, that's the thing. The thing is, not necessarily the time, but sometimes it's almost impossible to count. Like, let's say if you have a colony of cyanobacteria, you don't know what is a single individual, because you can have a slab with a lot of this sort of mesh, you know, thread-like structures, but you don't know where to start to count it. Depends on your eyes too. If you ask a colleague of mine to look at this, he may find more or less specimens. Or he may be able to recognize some things that I cannot recognize.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I know that you personally have examined over 70,000 specimens. I mean, when you go to sleep at night, are they still swimming before your eyes?
Well, that's what happens when you do a PhD. You plunge yourself into a topic, and that's what I did. And yes, that's correct. After spending 8 hours or 10 hours in front of your of the microscope, then of course, at the time, yes, I started to see a lot of specimens for sure, and to have memories. I mean, to memorize them in my dreams.
Okay, so you've got this enormous collection of Burgess fossils. Maybe we don't know quite how many there are, but it's definitely the world's biggest collection. How did you decide that a website would be the best way to share them with Canadians? Why not just put them on display?
Well, I have to say that the website is complementary to a display. It's not one or the other. I will say that the website itself is far better in many ways to display a lot of specimens, because in fact it's unlimited. You can put as many pictures of specimens as you want on the web, pretty much. Whereas on the floor, of course, in a physical display, then you have problems of space and obviously funding also to build an exhibit. The other advantage is obviously to be able to tell perhaps more thorough story. You have more space. In other words, you can spend more time to provide more information, and you can organize this information so that the information can be found quickly. The main goal really of this website is to educate people about the burr shell and for them to have finally a window into this fossil deposit that is well known to many, but in many ways not very well known, because there's not too many resources out there, especially online, available. When I started my job here in 2006, that's something I thought right away. We should really build a website. But I didn't want to build a website about the burr shell represented at the ROM. I wanted to build a website about the story of the burr shell and its fossils. And that means something a bit different here. That means that I had to include collections from all the other institutions with burr shell fossils, in particular the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, the Geological Survey of Canada in Ottawa, and as well as University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, which had very very old historical collections, and Harvard University as well.
I've been on the website all morning, and the main gallery is obviously a lot of fun. I mean, each creature's got its own quirks and unique characteristics. I'm wondering if you could maybe walk me through one or two of your favorites from the main gallery.
I have to say that it's hard to choose one or the other. I think I'm a bit in love for all of them, but I'm going to choose Nectocharis. Why Nectocharis? Well, it is an animal that had been studied in the 70s based on a single specimen, and the ROM found a lot of new specimens in the 1990s, and the specimen had been left unstudied. And I proposed to my graduate student, PhD student Martin Smith, to work on this material as part of his PhD. We worked together on a paper which has been published now in last year, in fact. We're describing this animal as an early squid-like animal. We interpret this as a cephalopod. Now, why is it important? Well, we think it is one of the earliest cephalopod that we know in the fossil record. And this particular animal is entirely soft-bodied. It shows a pair of antennae at the front or tentacles, a funnel, pair of eyes, and lateral lobes. It looks very much like a squid today, except the number of tentacles, of course. I like this animal. It's a swimmer. It's a relatively small animal, but it changes the view of the early evolution of cephalopod, and it just basically removes one of the problematic fossils of the burr shell, where before it was thought to be an enigmatic or problematic animal. Steve DeGould used the term weird wonder. Well, we don't think it's such a weird animal after all. It's connected to something we know. Well, a second animal I like is Anomalocaris. I like Anomalocaris for various reasons, but one is about its history. It has a long history of misunderstanding. And it started with having its claws being interpreted as a pair of shrimps. These discoveries were made by railroad workers, probably, and the fossil itself was described in 1892 by Whitevis, a Canadian paleontologist. The animal Anomalocaris canadensis means the strange shrimp of Canada, so it was thought that the claw itself was the body of a shrimp with a missing head. It's only after the discovery of the burr shell itself by Walcott in 1909 that other bits and pieces come out. But Walcott still didn't understand this animal very well, that the mouth parts, for example, were interpreted as being a jellyfish, and the body itself being interpreted as a sea cucumber. It's only about 100 years later, in 1992 that the story, well, all these bits and pieces came together into a single organism. There was a description made by Whittington and Briggs. They basically reconstructed the animal as being one of the largest predator in the fossil record, with the bodies of the shrimp being the pair of claws at the front. The animal will have had a very large eyes, a pair of very large eyes in front of the claws, and a body with a number of lobes along the side, which would have helped the animal to swim probably quite efficiently in the water column. Now, the best specimen in the world of this particular species, of this particular animal and species, is actually in our collection at the ROM and was found at about the same time.
What's the best way to think about these creatures? Can they be considered ancestors of modern animals, or is it better to think of them as distantly related but now extinct offshoots of groups that we would recognize today?
Well, I will choose the second. I will think they are offshoots of taxa we know today. When I say taxa, I'm talking about your body plants, so phyla. So they are offshoots, early offshoots for many of them of modern phyla, but not all. There are also some that are basal member of modern phyla. In other words, they are within a group that, you know, that we can define, let's say, as arthropods. They are true arthropods in the blue shell, and they are organisms that are going along that lineage of arthropods, not having all the features of arthropods, but they're not quite yet, they don't quite yet have all the features that are, that we define today as arthropods. So it's a bit of a mix, this assemblage of the blue shell. But at this time, there are very few organisms where we actually have no clue what group they belong. Well, there are fewer, at least. There are still a few that we don't really understand well. And there are still quite a number of organisms not yet redescribed or described at all. There are a number of new species from the blue shell, which might quite... be you know, separate lineages that at this time we cannot understand because of lack of specimens or material for comparison.
People are still bringing back fossils from the Burgess Shale. In an ideal world, if you had your wish, what would you most like to see them bring back?
Well, I'm still organizing expeditions there, it's my hope in the future is to discover new sites and to find, in particular, new fossils of chordates. Chordates are very rare. There's one from called Picaya from the Walcott Quarry. And other than that, there is possibly another species called Metaspergina, but this particular species is very poorly known. Only two specimens are known of it. So. That would be sort of a nice thing to find in the future, is a new site where you can find a new type of chordate. Chordates are very, very, very rare, and compared to, let's say, arthropods, which dominate the community, there are dozens and dozens of species of arthropods. Arthropods are still the most diverse group today, so perhaps it's not that a surprise. And chordates are very rare, and perhaps if you find 10,000 specimens of blue shell fossils, there may be one chordate in them. So it's quite rare.
Well, that's really interesting, considering that, you know, today chordates represent all the fish and amphibians and reptiles and mammals, including us. Dr. Caron, thanks very much for speaking with me today.
You're very welcome, and thanks very much for talking to you.
Dr. Jean-Bernard Caron is a curator of invertebrate paleontology at the Royal Ontario Museum. He oversees the world's largest collection of Burgess Shale fossils, and you can check them out on his brand new website. It's www.burgess-shale.rom.on.ca.